Today is May the 26th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. There is a global chip shortage, and it's driving up tech prices. And it looks like it's going to be a long-term thing before it ends. In recent months, the price of large TV models has shot up around 30% compared to last summer. The jump is a direct result of the current chip crisis and underscores that a fix is more complicated than simply ramping up production. It may also be only a matter of time before other gadgets that uses the same circuitry, such as laptops, tablets, and headsets among them, experience similar sticker shock. Some manufacturers have already flagged potential price rises. ASUS, a Taiwanese computer maker, said that a shortage of components would mean price hikes further upstream, which would likely affect consumers. Prices are definitely, unfortunately, going up for these components, says Synaptix, a company that sells integrated circuits for controlling touchscreen displays to manufacturers of consumer electronics. While the supply squeeze has been felt across the semiconductor industry, those supply-bound integrated circuits pose specific challenges. Since they are not especially advanced, the circuits are typically made at chip factories that are several generations behind the cutting edge. With chip makers focused on building more advanced fabrication plants that yield more valuable components, there has been little incentive to invest in capacity at older facilities. It's simply not possible to churn out more of them, even when demand spikes. All manner of devices have already been affected by the chip shortage. Sony said that the PlayStation 5 would remain in short supply through 2022 due to the crunch. Companies that act as electronics component brokers say that certain components have seen prices of jump orders of magnitude. Voltage regulators used in countless products that normally cost 50 cents have been selling for as much as $70. But at the consumer level, products that require display integrated circuits are feeling the impact first and hardest because of those factory limitations. Inventories have depleted, so those new prices are going to hit into the retail outlets and consumer consumption. While it's one type of integrated circuit, the impact is wide-ranging. Anything that has a screen built into it is going to be affected by these price increases. That includes PC makers, which have been able to avoid increases by selling devices for the same price, but with, for instances, less memory. A confluence of factors have contributed to the unprecedented chip drought. The pandemic sparked a boom in demand for home electronics and cloud services, and the economic slowdown also caused certain industries to badly misjudge how demand would fall. The impacts have been felt beyond traditional consumer technology as well. Car makers in particular were left flat-footed after expecting fewer sales. After preemptively canceling orders for semiconductor components, many auto manufacturers have had to stop production while they wait for supply reinforcements to arrive. Broader supply chain disruptions have hurt as well, including a fire in March that shut down a plant in Japan that makes a range of different semiconductor components, including display integrated circuits. Geopolitical tensions between the United States and China have also contributed. In the last few years, the U.S. government has imposed sanctions on major Chinese consumer tech companies, including Huawei and ZTE, blocking their access to the most advanced chips and prompting them to stockpile as many as possible. Many experts expect the semiconductor crunch to last for more than a year. and it may contribute to a redrawing of the global chip-making landscape. The shortage has highlighted the importance of chip manufacturing to many industries, and the most advanced chips will be vital to progress in key areas such as artificial intelligence, 5G, and military technology. The leading U.S. chipmaker, Intel, has fallen behind competitors like TSMC, which is the Taiwan Semiconductor Company in Taiwan, and Samsung in South Korea in recent years. But the company plans to invest heavily in an effort to regain a leading position. The U.S. government has also proposed a $50 billion stimulus for the U.S. chip industry in an effort to bolster American chip-making capabilities. While this will do nothing to help with the immediate situation, well, it's simple economics. It's going to take time. Smart plugs are the first easy step into home automation. You might be wondering what a smart plug is and what makes them so smart. What makes smart plugs smart? A smart plug is like a power point adapter. It fits between your power socket and the appliance you wish to plug in. At its most basic level, it simply turns things on and off. But when connected to a smart home platform, they let you control your appliances from an app on your phone from anywhere. It even lets you set schedules for your smart plugs so you can turn appliances on and off at set times and on specific days. Some smart plugs also go one step further and collect information about how much energy the appliances connected through it are using. This is an incredibly useful feature for the energy-conscious consumer. But how do you control them? Most smart plugs communicate using your home's Wi-Fi network to a central control hub. Then the hub uses your Wi-Fi to send information to an app on your phone. However, hackers can use smart plugs to break into your home network. Cheap smart plugs are a major cybersecurity vulnerability and could easily be used by criminals to break into a person's devices or even home. These smart plugs can be purchased for as little as $10. They can be used to obtain login credentials into the target's Wi-Fi network. This is made possible due to the fact that these devices communicate with the router via port 80, sending unencrypted HTTP traffic. Once the attackers obtain Wi-Fi credentials, they're able to connect to the target's network and from there do all kinds of mischief, from receiving video and audio from laptops, controlling vulnerable smart devices, downloading sensitive data, or even monitoring traffic from other devices. They could also use the Wi-Fi to download illegal material from the internet or launch attacks on other user devices with virtually no chance of being caught. This becomes even more problematic if these smart plugs are shared in the same network with smart door locks or video surveillance. An attacker with knowledge of when the residents are out and about could break into the premises. It is recommended that a separate guest SSID be set up for the Internet of Things gadgets so that important devices are not on the same network. Apple Senior Vice President of Software Engineering calls Mac malware levels unacceptable during the Apple versus Epic lawsuit trial. Apple Senior Vice President of Software Engineering Craig Federighi, when asked why the iOS App Store couldn't simply embrace the more open distribution model found on macOS, Federighi said, "Today we have a level of malware on the Mac that we don't find acceptable. 130 types of malware had been found targeting Macs in the past year, some of them quite successful. The question of security has been central to Apple's argument that it can't open up iOS to third-party app stores. But the answer is more complicated than it might seem. Apple does have an app store review process, but outside security experts have said it alone is insufficient to comprehensively root out both sophisticated malware and entry-level scams. Court documents show that one Apple executive said App Store security was like bringing a plastic butter knife to a gunfight. Apple's best protection comes from the iPhone itself, which is architected to minimize the damage malware can do if it manages to sneak in. But it's also true that Mac's malware problem is worse than it might seem. While App Store review process isn't perfect, switching to a Mac OS model would potentially expose users to more risk. As is often the case, it is one of many trade-offs. Pay TV providers lost nearly 1.9 million subscribers in the first quarter of this year. As more households trim their monthly entertainment budgets by cutting the cord and choosing on-demand streaming services, pay TV providers continue to see a decline in customers. The largest pay TV providers in the United States lost 1.9 million video subscribers in the first quarter of this year. A report shows that the top cable providers, including Comcast, Charter, Cox, Altice, MediaCom, Atlantic Broadband, and Cable One, lost 750,000 net video customers for the quarter. Other traditional services, such as AT&T, Premium TV, Dish TV, Verizon Fios, and Frontier were down over 860,000 subscribers for the quarter. The total was rounded out by live TV streaming services, Hulu with Live, Sling TV, and Fubo TV, combined with down over 250,000 for the quarter, though Fubo TV alone saw an increase of around 43,000. This did not include YouTube TV or Philos, as it didn't have access to current subscriber numbers. Pay TV net losses of about 1.9 million in the first quarter were similar to the net losses in the first quarter of the prior year. Over the past year, top pay TV providers had a net loss of 4.8 million subscribers compared to a loss of about 5.1 over the prior year. Big tech company Apple, named in a federal antitrust lawsuit filed by entertainment company. App Store curation is extensive censorship of independent developers, worthy of class action status. Primary Productions LLC recently charged Apple with antitrust violations of the Sherman Act, alleging restraint of trade for how the technology giant inhibits developer access to Apple's App Store and user base. The suit seeks class action status on behalf of millions of software developers that are blocked from the App Store in favor of apps developed by Apple and its affiliates. The complaint states it is first to file such a case protecting developers of free apps. In 2018, the group developed an app designed to educate the public about blockchain wallets by distributing hundreds of millions of dollars of free digital blockchain encryption currency, or also known as cryptocurrency. Apple killed the app before release because it allegedly threatens Apple's low-price gaming Apple Arcade, anti-competitive exclusion from a marketplace, such as that of smartphone-enhanced internet commerce, is prohibited by civil and criminal code formalized as the Sherman Act of 1890. The lawsuit states that Apple has so far distanced the independent developer from direct access to his or her audience, that critical commerce is restrained in violation of the Sherman Act. The lawsuit further states that in 2021 alone, as of filing, Apple has already rejected 1 million apps, representing millions of persons' hours of lost work or to appease the Apple giant. Apple is a monopoly retail buyer of apps and hence underpays developers, even those of free apps, when it disallows them or suppresses their ranking on the App Store, said attorney Keith Matthews. Broader than existing Apple antitrust litigation, this case finally protects independent developers of free apps. As for solutions beyond monetary damages, which could exceed $100 billion, the lawsuit demands an injunction requiring Apple to permit due process before denying an app, via an app court to act independently and thereby avoid the problem of favoritism and cronyism. Attorney Matthews' firm, Associated Attorneys of New England, seeks to join the New Hampshire-based Coronavirus Reporter app lawsuit to create a multi-district national litigation effort. That app, despite being designed by Dr. Robert Roberts, who consulted for NASA, developed the quantitative test that has been used to diagnose heart attacks and chaired the prestigious Fields Medal Committee, was blocked by Apple from being the first COVID-19 app in February 2020. Broadcaster's case against Locast. Locast is a not-for-profit service offering users access to broadcast television stations over the internet. They stream the signal over the internet to select U.S. cities. They are trying to help broadcasters reach people just like you over the internet. So, what is the problem? Broadcasters are moving forward in their case against Locast. The case against them is moving forward as ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC have filed a letter to the U.S. District Court of New York outlining their claims against Locast and asking the court to reject Locast's defense. The suit was initiated in July of 2019, over a year after Locast launched as a service to provide local TV channels in select markets via an internet connection. Locast justifies providing the service by arguing that it's protected under the Copyright Act. The broadcasters argue that Locast is retransmitting the signal of their local TV stations without permission. In a letter through their lawyers, the broadcasters made three claims: that Locast doesn't qualify for the copyright exception, which only applies to localized media; that Locast is gaining commercial advantage; and that Locast is charging for the service it offers. In a letter from Williams and Connolly, who represents the broadcasters, like many for-profit companies, Locast employs a freemium. What a word. F-R-E-E-M-I-U-M. A freemium business model. Specifically, following an introductory period, Locast interrupts a user's television stream every 15 minutes on a given channel with an advertisement asking users to pay $5 per month, which Locast labels a donation. If the user does not agree to pay the monthly charge, he or she is sent back to the Locast program guide and must navigate back to the channel he or she was watching. If, however, the user pays, he or she receives uninterrupted service for the month or a prorated portion thereof. Locast also filed a letter through Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. In the letter, the streaming service notes that it is operated by Sports Fan Coalition of New York, a 501c3 charitable nonprofit organization that does not gain anything financially from the service. No one owns SFCNY, which is the Sports Fans Coalition of New York. And the letter says that it pays no dividends, no distributions, and no salaries. It pays typical market prices for its costs, such as physical space, equipment, technical upkeep, and internet access. And it defrays those costs by seeking and accepting donations, including donations from viewers, for the actual and reasonable cost of maintaining and operating the secondary transmission service. Plaintiffs cannot dispute any of these facts. In Locast's letter, it was also mentioned that over half of the service's active members use Locast without making a donation. What this case is about is that the free TV channels over the air is being made available on the internet, and is this legal? Well, no, it's in the courts. Microsoft warns of a Trojan rat, also known as street rat, masquerading as a ransomware. Microsoft Security Intelligence researchers uncovered a malware campaign that is spreading a remote access Trojan rat being tracked as street rat. That's spelled STRRAT. The Microsoft team has outlined details of a massive email campaign delivering the street rat malware that they observed last week and reported in a series of tweets. Microsoft discovered malicious PDFs that download Java-based street rat, which can steal credentials and change file names, but doesn't actually encrypt. The Trojan rat has a focus on stealing credentials of browsers and email clients and passwords via keylogging. It affects the following browsers and email clients: Firefox, Internet Explorer, Chrome, Foxmail, Outlook, and Thunderbird. The Trojan rat can not only steal credentials and take control of systems, but also presents as fake ransomware. The rat was designed to steal data from victims while masquerading as a ransomware attack. According to Microsoft, the bad actors behind the campaign use compromised email accounts to send out spam messages containing an image that posed as a PDF attachment. The Java-based street rat was distributed in a massive spam campaign. The malware shows ransomware-like behavior of appending the file name extension .crimson to files without actually encrypting them. The malware supports multiple features such as collecting browser passwords, running remote commands and PowerShell, and logging keystrokes. Street Rat also has a unique feature not common to this type of malware: a ransomware encryption-decryption module that changes file names in a way that would suggest encryption is the next step. However, Street Rat stops short of this function. It just appends the file name extension .crimson to files without actually encrypting them, researchers said in one of the tweets describing the attacks. However, the so-called encryption only renames files by appending the .crimson extension. This might still work for extortion because such files cannot be opened anymore by double-clicking. Windows associates a correct program to open files via the extension. If the extension is removed, the files can be opened as usual. There is no ransom note template in the client of the rat. The attacker can display anything they like with the show message command. It is possible that the server provides ransom note templates. To launch the campaign, attackers used compromised email accounts to send several different emails. Some of the messages used the subject line, "outgoing payments." Others referred to a specific payment supposedly made by the accounts payable department, which is how the emails are signed. The campaign includes several different emails that all use social engineering around payment receipts to encourage people to click on an attached file that appears to be a PDF that actually has malicious intent. One email informs the recipient that it includes an outgoing payment with a specific number, presumably the attached PDF. Another addresses a message to a supplier and appears to let the receiver know that your payment has been released as per attached payment advice, asking the recipient to verify adjustments made in the attached PDF. The attached file in all these cases, however, is not a PDF at all, but instead connects the system to a malicious domain to download the street rat malware. Researchers said Microsoft 365 Defender can protect systems from street rat, while machine learning-based protections detect and block the malware on endpoints, alerting Microsoft Defender for Office 365 against malicious emails. Be on the alert and look for emails containing the domain names ending in .uk, as they are known to be associated with delivering the street rat malware. Google Assistant will soon be able to power off your Android phone. With Android 12, the Google Assistant gained the ability to be invoked by long pressing the power button, which normally opens Android's power menu. In turn, the Google Assistant is gaining the ability to power your phone off with your voice. Keep in mind that Google, as is their custom, putting things out for beta, may or may not ever ship these features. Android 12 is bringing a suite of visual and tactile changes to the operating system, including the new Material U design language. One of the changes we've seen already is a new way to access the Google Assistant beyond the current options like Hey Google and swiping up from the corner of the screen by long pressing your phone's power button. While this design brings Pixel phones in line with devices like the Samsung Galaxy series, it's quickly been spotted that Android 12 Beta doesn't currently offer any way to turn your phone off if you want to use long press to activate the assistant. It has been spotted one potential solution to this issue, with Google adding a power button to Android's quick setting area, but this isn't their only plan. The Google search app got a new beta update, and in it was an in-app explainer for the new way to use the assistant. In it was found that there will be two distinct ways to power off your phone on Android 12. Firstly, you'll soon be able to press power and volume up at the same time to access the power menu. More interestingly, it'll soon be possible to say something like power off to the Google Assistant to turn your device off. Currently on Android, the Google Assistant either tells you that power controls are not available or walks you through the correct way to shut your phone off. It's not clear at this point whether saying power off phone will immediately turn your phone off or it will open the usual Android power menu to interact with. Similarly, it's not sure whether or not this will be exclusive to Android 12 or to Google Pixel phones. Creating three new ways to do the same thing is something of a signature move for Google, so it should be interesting to see which of these power options stick around in the long term. And as always with Google, they got nice new features, but there's no documentation, so I'm not looking forward to learning more about it through their excellent non-documentation. Here's everything that was recently announced at the Google I/O Annual Developers Conference, where Google announced new hardware, software, and various updates for its existing apps and services. This year, Google I/O showcased a new look at updates across Google products. Google demoed Lambda, L-A-M-D-A, a machine learning model that improves on an artificial intelligence conversational skills. Lambda is meant to create a more free-flowing conversation that can jump between any topic. Android 12 gets a lot more colorful. One of the biggest changes is that Android 12 is getting a whole new look. Android users will be able to customize their own color palettes and redesign widgets that fit their backgrounds. So if you happen to choose a wallpaper of a certain color, for instance, Android 12 will automatically identify that color as the most prominent color and pick complementary shades for your widgets and what your entire operating system will look like. The new Material U design language can also be ported to other devices and apps. Android 12 is also getting more privacy features, including a dashboard that breaks down what data your apps are collecting, and Google also is working on creating an ecosystem of devices that work more seamlessly together. Photos and text sent to your Chromebook, built-in Chromecast remote controls, and digital car keys. Google Photos will also have a new memories feature. It finds three or more pictures that share a common element and groups them together and then resurfaces them. One demo Google showed involved an engineer's orange backpack. It created a collection based on a backpack. Also, Google's adding what is called Cinematic Photos. It's extremely similar to Apple's Live Photos, but one neat difference is that it can be used to stitch together similar photos scanned from old photo album, too. Google Maps is also getting a whole bunch of updates. To start, Maps will soon recommend routes that are less likely to cause you to suddenly slam on the brakes. That is to say, sharp corners, busy intersections, and so on. If you're walking, there's also a live view mode that overlays helpful information about your surroundings. That includes stuff like restaurants and shops, but also street signs to point you in the right direction at complicated intersections. Another neat feature is live area busyness, so you can see which neighborhoods are crowded so you can maintain social distancing. It works for the post-pandemic era as well, as it might indicate which areas have a lot of interesting events going on. Samsung is collaborating with Google on a new unified operating system that merges Tizen and Wear OS together. The new platform will also leverage some of Fitbit's know-how in the wearable space so that Wear watches will finally enter 2021 with the rest of the class. Absurd naming aside, Wear promises 30% faster app launching, app shortcuts, third-party tiles, more apps, and longer battery life. That in turn enables more advanced features like sleep tracking and continuous heart rate monitoring. Sounds great, but only time will tell whether this new hybrid operating system will deliver. Then there is Project Starline. It is Google's attempt at lifelike holograms. It's pitched as looking through a sort of a magic window during a call. In that window, you can then see a super realistic 3D image of another person who's not actually there. It combines computer vision, machine learning, spatial audio, and real-time compression. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Certifications and Training.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I give you a glimpse at the IT world and how it relates to technology and how it relates to all of the different things going on around it. And I want to dive into a topic that comes up on a regular basis. People ask me all the time about certifications. And are they needed? Are they relevant? How do you get them these days? And so forth. So let's go down a couple of different roads with this. My last true certification. Now, I've taken a number of courses along the way in various vertical applications or operating systems and so forth, but they haven't been certifications necessarily. And I'm kind of an exception to the rule, and a lot of this also is going to vary depending on the companies that you might be working for. Okay, so what do I mean by this? All right, there are companies that require that you have a certification in order to get a particular job in IT. Now, these certifications are required in some cases, or they're a gauge in other cases that is easy to assign. For instance, all right, so if I walk into a job and I say I want to be a Windows technician for them, or I want, in my case, it's more of a manager role, but in the Windows department, but moving beyond that, they'll look at my resume and they will realize that my last however many years, decades, I've been working with Windows on a professional level. I've been an IT administrator and dealing with all kinds of different things, and I've adapted. And that's a different kind of approach. For the people who are brand new in the market, yes, a certificate is going to be very valuable. It's a different kind of approach. We can look at, there are people who are successful in business. The laundry list is long of the various people in corporate IT worlds where they dropped out of high school or college and they moved forward and they made millions and they were successful based on their knowledge of technology and specific roles within technology. And a lot of companies recognize that there is a value to the real world practical experience. But if you don't have that real world practical experience, what do? You get a certification. I will forewarn you, that certification doesn't guarantee anything. That certification is relevant in that it gives you the head start, but it also says, hey, Joe over here just learned how to work with Windows or Linux or whatever it is. And that may be something that sets back the decision from the hiring IT person. not talking the HR human resources person. I'm talking about the hiring IT manager that's sitting there and going, I've got three resumes. I've got somebody who's just got certificates. I've got somebody who's just got experience. And I've got somebody who's got a little bit of both. Which one do I choose? And it's up to them. And if you have nothing, if you have no experience, getting a certification is going to be a leg up for you. It's going to be that way to get in the door and prove your mettle. Now, if that's your role, if that's your position, I do want you to expend a little bit more money on a server or whatever hardware and software that you need to practice this. What do I mean by this? All right. If you're going into the Windows world, you're being a Windows IT administrator, I want you to get a Windows server, and I want you to work with that on a regular basis, and I want you to challenge yourself to grow. I've done that in the past, and I still do that. I'm always learning more in regards to computers and technology. So, yes, certificates are relevant if you're new. Now, how do you get the training? How do you get the certifications? All of that's available online. They do these things called boot camps. Look up Linux boot camp, Windows boot camp. Actually, Windows administrator, Linux administrator boot camp, either one of those. And that is just if you want to go into one of those worlds. There are boot camps for different programming. You can learn how to code. It's not something anybody can do. It's not something everybody can do. Only individuals who have the certain talent for doing it. But we'll talk about that on a future show. But you can get the training. The unfortunate thing is they used to charge thousands of dollars for training, and it would include the hotel room, and you'd fly off to Houston, Texas, for instance. You'd fly into Houston, and you were responsible for the airfare. But they put you up in a hotel and you had this in-person experience, and they could work with you and make sure that you would get your certification. At the end of a week or 2 weeks, whatever it was, you'd have your certification. They're still doing that. You're just not flying to Houston. You're doing it from your home. And you know what they've given us as far as discounts for nothing, which is unfortunate. Look around. Local colleges often offer the certifications as well. Look for companies. There's a number of them out there. Pluralsight is one of them that just comes to mind. Lynda, Lynda, that also give you kind of that head start on that certification route. So look for them, explore, and yeah, good luck with that. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. This is a bizarre story of the inventor of ransomware. Back in December of 1989, 20,000 floppy diskettes were sent in the mail to attendees of the World Health Organization's AIDS conference in Stockholm. Attendees were expecting to see medical research when the disk contents were read. Those opening the diskettes became a victim of the first act of ransomware more than 30 years before the ransomware attack on the U.S. Colonial Pipeline ignited a gas shortage in parts of the United States. After inserting the diskette, a message appeared demanding that you send $189 in an envelope to a post office box in Panama. The incident created a lot of damage back in those days. People lost a lot of work, and it was not a marginal thing, it was a big thing even then. The scheme made headlines and appeared in Virus Bulletin, a security magazine for professionals, a month later. While the conception is ingenious and extremely devious, the actual programming is quite, well, untidy. According to analysis, it was a pretty basic malware. It was the first time many people had ever heard of the concept of digital extortion. It's unclear if any people or organization paid the ransom. The floppy diskettes were sent to addresses all over the world, obtained from a mailing list. Law enforcement traced the effort to a post office box owned by a Harvard-taught evolutionary biologist named Joseph Popp, that's P-O-P-P, who was conducting AIDS research at the time. He was arrested and charged with multiple counts of blackmail, and is widely credited with being the inventor of ransomware. Even to this day, no one really knows why he did this, noting how costly and time-intensive it would have been to mail that number of floppy diskettes to so many people. He was influenced by something. Perhaps someone else was involved as a biologist. How did he have the money to pay for all those diskettes as well as the postage? Was he angry about the research? Well, nobody knows. Some reports indicate Pop had been rejected by WHO for a job opportunity. After his arrest at the Amsterdam's Schiphol airport, Pop was sent back to the United States and imprisoned. He allegedly told authorities he had planned to donate the ransom money to AIDS research. His attorneys also argued he was not fit to stand trial. He reportedly wore condoms on his nose and curlers in his beard to prove he was unwell. A judge ruled in his favor. Pop passed away in 2007. The legacy of his crime persists to this day. Security experts believe ransomware attacks against both corporations and individuals will continue to grow because they're easy to execute, hard to trace, and the victims can be exploited out of a lot of money. Ransomware typically wreaks havoc on computer systems either after someone clicks on a malicious link and unknowingly installs software or from a vulnerability on an outdated server. One of the biggest problems about ransomware nowadays is that ransoms are often paid with cryptocurrency, such as Bitcoin, which is exchanged anonymously and not traceable. While most large-scale ransomware activity stems from organized crime groups, as is the case with the U.S. pipeline, Pop seemed to have acted alone. More than an actual criminal mastermind, he was what you would classify as a lone actor, as opposed to an organized crime syndicate or state-sponsored actor. His motivations appeared to be quite personal. He obviously had strong feelings about AIDS and AIDS research. While the reasons for his acts are unknown, Pop made a big effort to clear his name and move on to other pursuits. He self-published a self-help book called Popular Evolution, in which he advocated that the marriage age be lowered and young women focus their lives on birthing children. Before his death, Pop created the Joseph L. Pop Jr. Butterfly Conservatory in upstate New York. Is there honor among thieves? A crime forum is holding a quasi-judicial proceeding against DarkSide. Colonial Pipeline hackers have cashed out, and now they're feeling the heat. A crime forum is holding a quasi-judicial proceeding against the makers of DarkSide, the ransomware that shut down Colonial Pipeline, to hear claims from former affiliates who say the makers skipped town without paying. Or at least that's what members of the crime forum XSS is want us to all believe. XSS is a hackers forum. A Russian-speaking operative took to the XSS forum in November to recruit affiliates for DarkSide. At the time, DarkSide was a new ransomware as a service on the block, and it was in search of business partners. According to newly released figures from cryptocurrency tracking from firm Chain Analysis, DarkSide netted at least $60 million in its first 7 months, with $46 million of it coming in the first 3 months of this year. DarkSide made another $10 million this month, with $5 million coming from Colonial Pipeline and $4.4 million from chemical distribution company Brentag. Last week, DarkSide suddenly went dark and they disappeared. A post attributed to one of its members said his group had lost control of infrastructure and its considerable holding of Bitcoin. DarkSide posted the following message. At the moment, these servers cannot be accessed and the hosting panels have been blocked. The hosting support service doesn't provide any information except at the request of law enforcement authorities. In addition, a couple of hours after the seizure of funds from the payment server belonging to us and our clients were withdrawn to an unknown account. DarkSide hasn't been heard from since. Under the terms of the deal struck on XSS, DarkSide pays affiliates 75% of ransom that are less than $500,000. The cut rises to 90% for ransoms higher than $5 million. But according to multiple DarkSide affiliates on XSS, the ransom as a service provider has absconded without honoring its commitments. The affiliates have been asking to be reimbursed from a deposit with a balance of about $900,000 that DarkSide was required to make with XSS. There were three such posts. The notice used judicial terms such as plaintiff and defendant. It's not surprising that XSS organizers would police their site in precisely the same way seen in these discussions. After all, the cybercrime economy is booming, but for XSS to cash in, the forum has to be viewed as operating on a level playing field. Ultimately, though, it's impossible to know if these proceedings are for real or just an act. This is a community of cyber criminals who know their forum is being monitored, and it's highly likely that some communications are made solely to confuse issues. With DarkSide disrupting gasoline supply for large parts of the U.S. 2 weeks ago, the FBI will no doubt bring the full force of its might on this enterprise if it gets a chance. DarkSide owners are likely feeling the heat, even if the ransomware court proceedings are just an act. The ransomware problem isn't getting any better. In fact, it's poised to get even worse, as cyber criminals have begun experimenting with double encryption ransomware attacks. That works pretty much like exactly how it sounds. Victims pay a ransom to decrypt their files, only to find that they've been encrypted by another strain of malware simultaneously. It's a dirty trick. But if recent weeks have shown anything, it's that there's no low to how these groups will stoop. Ransomware attackers lock up Ireland's hospitals, then give away the key a little over a week ago. The Conti ransomware gang hit Ireland's National Health Service, known as HSE. The result has been chaos, with hospitals disrupted across the country and patient data dangled as extortion bait. This week, Conti said it would hand over the decryption key so that healthcare providers can get back to business, but still demanded a nearly $20 million ransom, threatening to sell or release the patient data if HSE didn't pay up. Ransomware not only denies access to your data, but demands a ransom be paid. Criminals are increasingly turned to so-called double extortion, where they threaten to expose sensitive user data if a separate ransom isn't paid. To avoid these attacks, don't click links from unknown or anonymous sources via messages or emails altogether. Unbeknownst to many consumer users of Windows, Microsoft offers a built-in ransomware protection as part of Windows Defender, found under Virus and Threat Protection. Windows 10 ransomware protection is available for consumers starting with those using Windows 10 version 1903. That's 1903. Windows 10 includes a ransomware protection feature that is comprised of two components, controlled folder access and ransom data recovery. Controlled folder access will allow you to specify certain folders that you wish to monitor for and block changes to the files contained in them. This will block all programs but the ones you allow from making any modifications of files within monitored folders, which would protect them from being encrypted by ransomware. The other component is ransomware data recovery, which will automatically sync your common data folders with your Microsoft OneDrive account in order to back up your files. Ransomware victims with this feature enabled can then use OneDrive to recover their files if they ever become encrypted by ransomware. In Windows 10 version 1903, Windows Defender ransomware protection is disabled by default. In other words, using Windows 10 version 1903, this feature of ransomware protection is off, and you have to turn it on. However, I'll mention how to enable it so that you can protect your computer against ransomware attacks. Unfortunately, if you have a third-party antivirus software installed, and Windows Defender real-time protection is disabled, the ransomware protection feature screen and control folder access feature won't be accessible. Now, how do you get to the ransomware protection in Windows 10 using Windows Defender? First of all, you don't use anybody else's antivirus software, just use Windows Defender. You type randomware protector in the search bar to access it and turn it on. Alternatively, users may head to Settings, Update and Security, Open Windows Security, Virus and Threat Protection, Manage Ransomware Protection to toggle it on. Now, there are some tactics that you can use to fend off ransomware. It is strongly suggested by cybersecurity professionals that you use a cloud-based file hosting service with automatic backup, such as Microsoft's OneDrive, so you're regularly backing up files. Another good defense is so-called air gap strategy, where the external storage device is completely disconnected. That is to say, offline from your computer and the internet. Back up your files, then disconnect the storage device. Another piece of advice is to separate work and personal devices. While attackers tend to target corporations, schools, and hospitals, we may see consumers who are working from home and doing their shopping on their work devices get targeted by attackers. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival, the original personal computer festival, was virtual this year. It took place on March the 20th, 2021. It was a 100% virtual event via Zoom teleconferencing. There were talks and forums via Zoom during the course of the day, and there were 10 simultaneous event tracks. Jerry Foster, CTO and co-founder, Plex Systems, delivered the TCF 2021 keynote speech, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. The TCF session recordings, the program grid, and the program guide are free and available for download on the website tcf-nj.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Dazzling Dinners Through Technology and Culinary Creativity, Thursday, May the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, June 3rd, 2021 at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, June 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, June 10th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, June 11th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.